Greetings, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, broadcasting live from East SETI, the sanctuary based in Trolloc, Washington, otherwise known as Paranormal Central, where the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and the children, well, most of them have been abducted, anyway. But we've got a great show tonight here. Not much to update on the UFO activity lately other than they're popping up all over the world, and seems like Stevensville, Texas is going nuts with more sightings, and everybody is calling their relatives to come look at them, and they're putting on quite a show there. But in our neck of the woods, we've had pouring rain and fog and not too much activity because we haven't been out there to look up. Can't see anything anyway, so... We have taken some amazing footage. We got the mountain to open up again, a massive beam coming off the mountain, and we got it all on film right dead center in the mountain when they opened up the door. And our guest tonight, probably tell us a little bit about that door opening up. Brooks, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, James.
Oh, glad to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
You know, rather than going into all your... And I'm looking at all your PhDs and doctorates and everything else here, and the amazing books you wrote, The Ark of a Million Years. And you have three books out now, don't you?
Yep, three books out. They're now available as a trilogy.
Oh, great. And, you know, you've also got, you've been playing around with all kinds of energy technologies, which I'm also fascinated with, and There's three areas I'd love to get into. One, we can start off with some of the... I know you put together a major biodiesel facility.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it started operations today. Started manufacturing at the rate of just about 8 million gallons a year. It's running right now, right outside my door.
Holy smokes. So I guess I'll be driving to your place to fill up my truck pretty soon. As soon as I get one that runs on diesel. But and you've got some other projects. I guess you've got your finger on all kinds of projects going on, and so you have to keep us informed on some of the other things that you're working on as well.
Sure. Yeah, we've got a yesterday just received what we call a sled, which is a truck with no engine, because we're going to put an electric motor in it, and it's going to be a fully plug-in electric pickup truck.
Hmm.
Pretty nice vehicle.
How far can you go on this?
Well, this one's designed to go about 50 miles, but it will reach speeds of 55 miles an hour. So
wow.
It is a not a freeway vehicle, but it's a highway vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how you drive, stop and go, or foot on the floor, you should be able to get between 50 to 60 miles out of this vehicle and still have a payload of 1,000 pounds.
You know, that sounds great. That's been one of my dreams. I've been wanting to convert my existing trucks or do something else. I think if we go electric and get that whole setup in there, it's just a matter of time before we get some kind of a fuel-less energy generator that...
Yeah.
You know, plug that in and then you go forever.
Sure. Well, yeah, that remains to be seen. I mean, that's what's really holding back the electric car industry is there's so many changes in battery technology. Everybody's, you know, waiting to introduce their car until the next great battery technology comes out. But, you know, our company holds the top three world records for electric cars. We hold the fastest time to Pikes Peak with an electric vehicle. We have the longest distance on a single charge, over 450 miles. And these are not vehicles with bicycle tires. These are regular production vehicles that you drive on the highway.
Wow. And it goes how far? What was the distance on that?
453 miles that car went. It broke, we broke the record three times.
Wow.
With that car. So we hold the top three distance records with that one.
Boy, I want one of those.
Yeah, it was a Geo, a small, almost 2,000-pound car, and it was with a special battery that we have a license to. It's the same battery that's used in the F-16. So nobody else in this country has a license for that battery. We just don't manufacture it right now.
Yeah. Have you looked into those magnetic motors as well?
I have. I actually investigated three of them, and I failed... Well, I should say that the prototypes failed to impress me. I just, none of the motors actually did what the inventors said they would do.
That seems to be common. You know, I know I've held in my hand some technologies that are just mind-blowing, but unfortunately we can't get those out right now because the inventors have had just too many problems with them. But I think it's a matter of time. It's going to be coming out real soon that, you know, we'll
I think
have...
so. I mean, here in Washington State, the electricity is so cheap, between 3 and 6 cents per kilowatt hour, which is probably the cheapest in the country. And right now this state has an energy surplus because of the incredible snowfall they had last winter.
Yeah.
All the lakes are still full and the dams are still cranking electricity. So it's probably going to be a winter like that again. So to have a plug-in vehicle up here that effectively gets between 140 and 160 miles per gallon, most people live within 20 miles of work, so a plug-in vehicle is extremely practical.
Yeah, that would be great here. I know just to get into town here, it's about 25 miles to get into town, into Hood River, and 25 back, you know, if you could plug it in there with a 50 mile, you'd be okay. But
yeah, and these batteries recharge to 90% in 1 hour, and then it takes about 7 hours to get the last 10% because it's a trickle charge. And we have some recharge events with the car, like inductive braking and things like that. But we try to do it inexpensively. These pickup trucks will sell for less than $20,000. So it's a great entry-level vehicle. It's got an extended cab and air conditioning and all of that.
Yeah, air conditioning just really sucks the energy, doesn't it?
Well, it depends, you know. It really depends. Actually, it only takes about 2 horsepower. To run the air conditioner, and that's when the vehicle's hot. Once the interior cools off, then the air conditioning only needs to come on and off when the temperature requires it. Most vehicles have a magnetic clutch, so the compressor just freewheels like your water pump does until the compressor's needed, and then it clicks in and you compress the Freon and make it operate. But these little cabs have very small air conditioners. They just don't. They don't take much to run.
I'm waiting for the counter gravity to come out.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a lot of people working on that, and I don't think much beyond a few micrograms has been accomplished, even with large amounts of power.
Yeah.
The only hope is that someone's able to create some kind of unified field in which that gravity becomes inertia free, so that you can kind of push it around like you would, you know, something that's buoyant in water.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, you create a gravitational field that's buoyant in our gravitational field.
You still have to propel it after that. You just have basically lift.
Right.
And then I know there's a difference. They have anti-gravity, which just holds things up, and then they have a thing called counter-gravity, and that propels things.
Right, where you're able to direct the gravity in the direction that you want. And evidence that we've seen, and I've got photographic proof, and you've seen it too, the ships that are able to do this have a plasma field that they direct. It does two things. First, it bends light, so you can't really get a clear photograph of these vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing it does, unfortunately, is it bathes the occupants in the immediate area around the craft in heavy electromagnetic radiation. So we don't know how that affects their biology or off-worlder biology, but it does have an effect on mortal biology. Long-term exposure to it can cause cancer.
You know, we had an event here where we had a ship hovering right over this one tree, and we came out the next year and looked at this tree, and it was basically an aspen tree. And the leaves were just enormous on it the following year. And I pulled these leaves off and showed people, and they're just blown away. They've never seen a leaf that big. It was like almost 50 times bigger than a regular leaf.
Hang on 1 second, James.
Sure.
Oh, that's good. A little more catalyst then, maybe?
Yeah, we've had all kinds of activity up here, and physical evidence to boot. you know, as well as a nice big burn mark in the middle of my chest from one of my encounters.
Oh, right.
But, yeah, it's pretty interesting. I haven't died yet, so. Not that I know of, anyway. I might be in a parallel universe right now on the radio and not know any better, but I think I'm still here.
No, you're still here.
Yeah.
Although it might be an illusion.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to get into is, I don't know which topic you want to get into first, but I want to talk about Galactic Plane or the Dark Rift. Everybody has a little bit different name for it. And get into your inner Earth expedition. So probably let's take the Galactic Plane first and end on a real positive note with the inner Earth expedition.
Well, it doesn't take much observation on a clear night where you have very little light pollution. If you look up at the Milky Way, you'll notice somewhere in the middle of it, there is what's called a rift. Astronomers like to call it the rift in the Milky Way, but ancient astronomers, the Mayans in particular, called it, the great vagina of the galaxy. And they believed, and they record in their holy book called the Popol Vuh, that this is the origin of planet Earth. And in our first book, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 1, we actually talk about a trans-dimensional Earth that merges with this Earth to form a dual matter Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of has temporal matter and spiritual matter occupying the same space at the same time. Not so outlandish when you think of the human body. I mean, we're basically temporal matter, you know, peas and carrots and calcium and water. But we're animated with this other matter, which creates kind of an energy body inside of our regular physical body. And it's the same thing with the Earth. So the idea is that every 26,000 years as we complete the precession, which is a trip through the zodiac in the stars with the axis of the Earth, and right now we're coming to the starting point of that again, or the ending point, depends on how you want to look at it, the end of the age of Pisces. We're getting ready to enter the age of Aquarius. We enter what appears to be a thin plane of very intense gravity. It's probably caused by a supermassive spinning black hole in the center of the galaxy, and that's the rift that we can see. As we near it, it'll become more and more pronounced. But as Earth gets close to this, all kinds of changes are happening to elements and DNA that are quite amazing and quite unexplained, because we really don't have any recorded history to go by. We don't understand what is going to happen. We just can record it as it happens. It's predicted, however, that in this plane of very intense gravity, there also resides some very dense matter called dark matter. Now, it permeates the universe, but it's particularly agglomerated or collected in this galactic plane. Now, there was a theory put forth called the black axiom, which basically means that when solar systems go through a plane like this, they're sort of spray painted halfway if they revolve very slowly, or quite evenly if they revolve very quickly. If you take two bodies which we know very well, the Earth and the Moon, the Earth revolves once every 24 hours and the Moon revolves once every 28 days. So if that theory holds, if the solar system actually went through something like this in the past, then the Moon should be approximately half black and half white, and the Earth should be fairly well coated with that same kind of material. And lo and behold, when we began to orbit the Moon, we noticed that the far side of the Moon is actually not the dark side of the Moon. It's the bright side of the Moon. It's six times whiter than the side that faces us. The side that faces us has an albedo of 10%, which means approximately 10% of the sun's light is reflected back out into space. But the other side of the Moon has an albedo of 60%. That means 60% of the sun's radiation is reflected back out into space. If that side of the Moon faced Earth, you'd have to wear sunglasses at night with a full moon. So it appears as though the theory of the black axiom holds water. Now, we didn't stop there. We went out into the asteroid belt, and there are some fairly well-known large asteroids that revolve very slowly. And lo and behold, as we began to take sharper and sharper images of these large asteroids, guess what? They're coated, half black and half white. We don't really know what the black material is. It may be graphite. It may be iron. But there is evidence that going through this galactic plane is cataclysmic to the surface of every body that goes through it.
Whole lot of yin-yang asteroids out there coming in. It also seems to totally affect our gravitational fields, because I noticed that everybody I've talked to, they said the fields are weakening as we move towards this galactic plane or this dark rift.
Well, there's an interesting realization that is called the Coriolis effect, and we really didn't think it had anything to do with Earth until most recently we realized that it's quite possible that the crust and the core of the Earth are rotating at different RPMs, different revolutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why we have such a strong, well-defined magnetosphere. Not all planets in our solar system have that. But that lends itself, when you get close to another strong gravitational field, it lends itself to a wobble. And the wobble can actually, in very short order, like a matter of days or even weeks, can become highly unstable, and you can actually have a pole shift in a planet that exhibits this kind of behavior. And it looks like at least the alignment of the North magnetic pole with the planet Earth, it is wobbling quite a bit, sometimes 1, sometimes 2 degrees.
And there have, I mean, being working in geology, which I know you have a long history in, you're probably pretty aware of the cycles, which show that we went through some kind of a shift. It wasn't just a magnetic pole shift. It was definitely a full pole shift, and it shows up in the geology.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that as lava comes to the surface and it cools or freezes into igneous rock, it assumes the magnetic alignment of the planet at that time. And geological surveys in the Norwegian area, we see a very broad and regular spectrum of magnetic alignments, which means the Earth has been tilting on its axis on a fairly regular basis for a long, long time, millions, perhaps billions of years. And those alignments have been captured in the rock, in the mountains of the Norwegian area.
What are the cycles, and what are the timelines in between each cycle? Are you aware of that?
That's a really good question. I don't think that anybody has a confident feel for that interval. I'm not really sure what the interval might be. What is universally accepted is that right now we are long overdue for a cataclysmic shift. And it may be 30,000 years overdue, and it may be 2,000 years overdue. But the idea that it has happened in the past on a fairly regular basis, and now we are on borrowed time,
mm-hmm.
is pretty prevalent.
Yeah, it's like time and a half is over, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're in overtime.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I've heard a lot of different theories, and I've heard one, you know, said every 12,000 years, once every 50,000 years, and so I've always tried to nail that down. Is there any evidence that shows that on the clockwork, you know? And I would say, I know every 26,000 years, every 13,000 years, we have major cataclysms happen.
Yeah. The last one, the best date that we have is 11,500 years ago, 9,500 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
They've nailed many paleoarchaeologists and paleobotanists have confirmed, based on flora and fauna that has been slurried and then jammed into what's called muck vents up high up in these mountains. They've actually core drilled these things,
mm-hmm.
dated them, and found that date to be really, really accurate. 9,500 BC, there was a terrible cataclysm with 600 to 800 meter high tidal waves that just devastated large regions of the planet. And it could have been from a pole shift, it could have been from an asteroid event, or we have actually seen mountains that become unstable and they'll slough off into the sea. And when they do, they create a huge tidal wave, which basically goes from one coast and then ricochets back and hits the coast it just came from, and it can just be devastating.
And those seem to be like clockwork. I know they had a two major swells, like mini tsunamis, in some of the local harbors here. On I can't remember if Boston Harbor had one not too long ago, and then Trinity, the other harbor, where they had a 12-foot swell or something come in just unannounced. They had no idea. It did a lot of damage to boats and docks. And
there's a phenomenon called a rogue wave. Seafaring logbooks have recorded this for centuries. I mean, as long as man has been sailing. These are like tidal waves, but they move very quickly, like 400 to 500 miles an hour under the water. And where the water's deep, it just it doesn't do anything. But where the bottom of the sea comes up, say, to a couple hundred feet deep or less than that, these swells can, you know, get up to 80 or 90 feet high, moving that quickly. And there used to be a rare event. Now, shipping companies are reporting rogue waves about once a month, and sometimes more often than that. And they try to use radar and even satellite data to warn, especially these super tankers, so they don't get broadsided by a 90-foot wave. But these cruise ships are reporting them on a regular basis, these rogue waves. And if they happen to hit a shore, you're going to get something just like you saw in Malaysia back in 2004.
I heard one cruise ship not too long, it was last year, got hit by one of these, and it went up over the decks, and everything did a lot of damage.
Yeah, it's just one wave, but it comes, you know, so suddenly and without any kind of warning or ability to correct from it. And, of course, most of the ships now are very stable. But still, you know, something that comes up over a 90-foot deck of a ship can be really scary.
Yeah, that's how I started my journey. I had those sneaker waves came in, and it was there was about 6 to 8 foot waves at the most. And I was out body surfing, and the next thing I know, they went up to 25 feet.
It was, oh, 25 feet, that's big.
Yeah, it was recorded in the newspaper, 17 to 25 foot waves, just immediately, and they came in and they just cleaned everybody off the docks and did a lot of damage. But I was out body surfing when it happened, and after about you got hit by the third wave, it, you know, I gave up and went through the tunnel, which is another long story. But anyway, I have a lot of respect for the ocean and nature after that, and
that's why you live in the mountains now.
Yeah, I live pretty far away. Yeah. I still go down. I love a nice, warm, sunny beach and swimming with the dolphins if I can and things of that nature. Hopefully I'm going to be doing that pretty soon here. But the next subject I want to get on to is the Inner Earth Expedition that you're getting ready to embark on.
Right, August 17th, 2009. We're hoping to take 100 with us.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's very expensive. It's about $1.8 million to take 100 people on this cruise, or this chartered voyage. And it's it's billed as you know the greatest expedition in the history of the world, and it may very well be. Of course, we might just see ice and whales, and that's about it. But on the other hand, certain evidences that we have collected, and the fact that certain areas of the ocean are now open to be sailed by icebreakers where they have been covered for over 200,000 years with ice. Thanks to global warming, we're going to get to see a portion of our planet that's never been seen before.
Now, they've got, this is a Russian icebreaker, I guess, that you've chartered.
Now, the Yamal is in dry dock right now. It's being upgraded, and it won't be ready for another couple of years, but its sister ship is the one that we're going to be taking on the cruise, and it's just as well outfitted as the Yamal, but I think it has 60,000 horsepower instead of 75,000 horsepower. Mm-hmm. It'll make it.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a visit the other night. I was meditating, and I had a visit from one of those little inner earth guys. I'll have to tell you later about it. But there's something up, definitely something going on. It just kind of appeared to me, and then with another person, then disappeared. So I haven't had a chance to you know, hook up with that again and find out what that was about. But definitely something.
Well, one way or the other, we're going to go. I mean, we may take our core group of 13 and not spend the money to bring, you know, 87 more people.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a shame because it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for geologists, oceanographers, tectonic experts, astronomers, to take a 15-day excursion to a place they could never afford to do on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But we ran ads with the Geological Society of America in their publication and at their convention last month. We have sent out over 20,000 individual newsletters. And, you know, so far we've only had three universities show any interest at all. But no budgetary assistance. So right now, Phoenix Science Foundation is footing the entire bill, which is not what it was designed to do. We thought that there would be enough interest worldwide that raising $2 million to make a voyage like this, which shows unbelievable returns on investment, and not only just the funds from the sale of the documentaries, but also the literally decades of data that could fuel dozens and dozens of PhD theses by grad students or even other PhDs who want to put themselves on a Nobel track for geology or for oceanography. This is an unprecedented opportunity. But so far, there's a lot of fear out there, and they have not answered the call.
You know, I know it's a lot of people I run across. You know, just the other day I had somebody doing this smirk thing, like, you know it all. And, So, you know, there's people there in the inner earth or whatever, you know, and I just, and I, you know, I told them, I said, well, have you done any research? And they said, no, but science told us this and this and this. And I said, well, not exactly. I said, if you really look at the cutting edge science, it all makes sense. And they're giving me some explanation. Well, you know, if you went into the inner earth, you'd fall, you'd fall in back into the middle, and you'd never get out, or something. I can't remember what it was. Some concept about gravity, where, you know, mass attracts gravity, so you'd have probably less gravity on the interior, but you'd still have gravity where you could walk around.
Well, Newton had what he called thin crust gravitation. And his idea was that once you are on the interior of a thin sphere, gravity would be zero because the side that what would happen is gravity would be equal in all directions. So therefore, you would be weightless. And when it came to thick crusts, it's kind of interesting because he doesn't have any data, which we now do have data, but he didn't have any data. So he just made an assumption that a thick crust is just an infinite number of thin crusts. So you can just take a reading anywhere you want, whether it's 2 feet in or 20 miles in or 200 miles in, and you're going to get the same result. And what has happened now is we've drilled almost 10 miles into the earth, which is well below, well, it's the deepest holes in history. And what we're finding is the temperature is elevated up around 400 degrees Fahrenheit, but gravity is certainly present. So it would seem that Newton made an assumption that the data does not support. So you're exactly right. If you got through the crust, and say the crust was 800 or 900 miles thick, you would still have some 5,000 miles of core that you could explore. And the idea is that perhaps the crust itself might have some gravity and actually have an attractive force from the inside.
Yeah, I think we've got a caller on the line. Do we have a caller?
Yes. Again, a caller all the way from Ontario here.
Oh, great.
Favorite fan.
State your name and where, I guess you already stated where you're from.
Yeah, well, it's Tim Cote again from Ontario, Canada. Just like to listen to it on the radio show every Saturday night. So I only start partying at midnight, that is, every Saturday. Basically, my question is for the gentleman that you're doing your interview with. More so, he was doing a expedition, I guess, for 100 seats and to the core of the earth or whatever it may be. And I was looking at the seats and what they're reserved and who they're reserved for. And I'm just a Joe Schmo. But I have the money and I want to go. You know what I mean? So, like,
welcome aboard.
Yeah. Right on. Well, that's it. That's more than likely what I would like to do. But I am no scientist, nothing of that sort. I'm just in it for the ride. So I'm a truth seeker, more or less, and I would definitely like to join. So I see your website, and is that an okay? Is that a go ahead?
Well, yeah. What we initially did 3 years ago, when Stephen Curry was leading this effort, and I was just a follower. They attempted to do this as a tourist trip, and what happened was about 20% of the roster filled up with tourists. And then, for one reason or another, Stephen Curry died an untimely death. He just did. I spoke to him in November, and by August he was dead. It was just very sudden and a shock to everyone. But what we did at that time was we reevaluated the expedition and decided to make it more a mainstream scientific expedition. Yes, we're going to take water samples and pictures and shoot film and all that. And if we put ourselves in the right place at the right time with the right consciousness of people in a scientific manner, we felt it was highly probable that if there was some dimensional Indiana Jones aspect to being at the top of the earth, for instance, an opening into the inner earth, it might make itself known to us. So we kind of shied away from the tourist roster and more toward the scientific roster. And of course, we realized immediately that all scientists are poor and pick crumbs with the sparrows. So we looked for investors to make up the difference in hopes that they would sponsor these scientists to go on the expedition, take their measurements, and return with a magnificent report from which they might get a return with the subsequent documentaries. We now realize that we have to have a mix of both. We have to have people that are truth seekers like yourself that can easily be trained in a matter of 2 days to take water samples and catalog things and make yourself very useful, instead of sitting on a lounge chair at 26 degrees out on the deck watching 120-foot waves come over the railing.
Beautiful. Wow. Well, that's definitely the journey that I'd like to take. So I'd check up your website further to get involved if that is an option. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And we've got a new website. We picked up a new webmaster just for this project, and she's an event planner. So she's a very detail-oriented person, and that new website is npiee.org, NPIEE.org. It stands for North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. And it's real short, easy to find, NPIEE.org. All the forms and everything that you need are there. The contact information is there. And if we've got accounts set up, and we're ready to go.
Yeah, spot on.
We're doing this as a joint venture with Poseidon Adventures, which is the charter company that charters these Russian icebreakers. And they've actually agreed to cover half the cost of the charter. So that means that our passengers only have to cover half the cost, and that will be great.
Is that $1.8 million? Is that what you're trying to raise to go ahead?
Yeah, so now all we need is $0.9 million to make it happen.
Well, $900,000.
Right.
And if you can get 100 people, that's $9,000 each.
That's not too hard to do.
Heck, I'll write you
a
check
tonight. That's pennies. Well, you know what? You can count me and the wife in, that's for sure. And I'll get to your website, email you, and we can definitely talk further about that.
Excellent.
And I'll let you guys get back to talk.
All right.
Okay, thanks for calling.
You guys got a lot to say, so thank you, James, and have a good night.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Ciao. Bye.
I can vouch for Tim. He'll definitely keep it an exciting trip. You know?
Oh, fantastic.
Nobody, they had such enthusiasm here, and when the ships did come in, we had 2 days of rain and clouds, and when the ships did come in, boy, talk about exciting. You know,
wow.
I've never seen anybody express so much excitement. But as long as he doesn't scream again. Last time he screamed so loud, I think he took down a couple of the ships. But no, it was pretty amazing. But this, you know, going back to the inner Earth, I was trying to explain to somebody that mass actually creates the gravity, and so the mass is pulling people down on the surface of the Earth, and if it was hollow, the mass on the interior would actually hold you to the ground on the interior of the Earth.
Yeah, especially if the crust, makes up a significant amount of the gravity, and everyone knows that gravity lessens with the square of the distance. So if you are, say, 400 or 500 miles away from the core of the Earth, but you're standing on the inside of the crust of the Earth, which is 800 or 900 miles thick, then the gravity of the crust is going to pull you more aggressively than the gravity of the core.
Mm-hmm.
However, it makes complete sense that the gravity on the inside of the crust would be far less than it would be on the surface.
I'm all for that, being that my back's been kind of really bothering me lately. I've been working my butt off up here on the mountain. I could use a little less gravity. But I don't think I'd be coming back, you know, to be honest with you. I went in the interior. Now, Admiral Byrd went to the interior of the Earth, and that's very well documented. I totally believe that story. I think there's somebody from, was he Sweden or from Finland? I can't remember. There's another account of a guy going, and he wrote a book about it. It's very hard to get. But
yeah, there are a couple books out. One is called Edidorfa, which mm-hmm. is Aphrodite spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about a story of a person that walked into the inner Earth from Mammoth Cave. And I've been to Mammoth Cave, every corner of it, and there is no opening and no legend of anyone doing such a feat. And the other book is called The Smoky God, mm-hmm. and that one's pretty easy to get your hands on. That one's probably less well documented, except for the fact that the gentleman that spent 18 years in an asylum because he claimed that he made this trip, he was finally let out and moved to Santa Monica, California. That one, at least you have a fairly reliable eyewitness there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Admiral Byrd, who didn't officially record anything like what his, quote, diary says or what the cult of inner Earth enthusiasts assigned to him. Because mm-hmm. he was a military man, obviously an aviation hero. Anybody that can fly for that long at 2,500 feet altitude over Arctic conditions and return to tell about it, not once but twice, is an aviation hero. And he certainly deserves and has earned that title. However, I can't really find anything in his own hand or his own logbooks or any photographic proof of any journey into the interior of the Earth. What he did record is that while he was flying along, you know, eating cookies and drinking milk, minding his own business, all of a sudden there's green foliage and liquid water and large animals underneath him,
mm-hmm.
and he's going, wait a minute, you know, I'm in a three-engine biplane. There is no way I have flown all the way to tropical paradise. Where the heck is this place? It's not on any map. It shouldn't be here. So that is the phenomenon that he recorded. And
yeah, I remember that's the part that I read about. You know,
yeah.
And to me, just that alone would suggest that things do start warming up the closer you get to the poles, and there would be some kind of an opening there that would kind of undermine the officialdom story, you might say.
Yeah, and there's some biology to back it up, too. We have the Ross Gull, which was discovered by my great-great-grandfather, Sir James Ross, who also discovered the magnetic North Pole. This is a small little slight gull that flies north in the winter. Well, it's not built for cold weather. It's just a springtime bird.
Mm-hmm.
But it obviously has someplace warm that it flies in the wintertime in the north. No one's ever been able to track it. And I've spoken to the best ornithologists in the world and two highly published, world-renowned experts on the Ross Gull, and they have no idea where this gull flies in the wintertime. They would love to track this gull and find out where it goes. The other is honeybees. Honeybees also fly north in these regions of Iceland for the winter. And we don't have any idea where they go. They show up dead on the snow if they don't make the trip, and the snow gets covered with pollen from flowers. And as far as I know, there's no flowers in polar bear country. But somewhere up there in the north, there is a place, and it may not be very big. It may only be 20 or 40 or 50 miles across, mm-hmm. from which the warm wind blows. And when it blows, it brings biology, both flora and fauna, from wherever this warm place is, out onto the ice.
Now, now I've seen photographs that have been censored quite a bit. They're NASA photos that somehow were released, and I don't know about the authenticity of them, but they definitely show an opening. And from my understanding, from my other connections, they make it very clear that all planets are hollow, and that's, you know, the way they're created. They're bursts from suns, and they find a cradle orbit where they're spinning. And when you have this centrifugal force and it's spinning, all the heavier elements go out to the core and, you know, create the surface, and then they start gathering more material from space. And it totally makes sense if you think of it in that nature. But, you know, and if it was a hot, swirling, gaseous ball, like coming from a sun, then it would start cooling and condense, and then you'd have the smoky sun or the, you know, in the interior.
Right.
And, you know, that all makes sense to me. And from what I've heard from other physicists or people that are checking out the heavens up there, they said there's light shooting through the poles of Mercury and other planets up
and
there.
Venus and Saturn,
yeah,
and Jupiter.
Exactly.
Yeah, so. You know, the generally accepted theory is that planets form from spinning clouds of gas we call accretion disks.
Mm-hmm.
And as the disks collapse, they form the planets around the sun, which is most often the center body in these accretion disks. But you have to consider that as large revolving areas get smaller and smaller, in order to conserve momentum, they spin faster and faster. And what happens is these planets do one of three things. A, they can explode. B, they can split or throw off a piece of themselves, forming a moon, which is what Mercury was once to Venus.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is that they can crack and then cool and then crack and then cool, and they become fairly stable, like Earth. And if you take a trip down to the bottom of the ocean off the coast of Hawaii, you will see Earth doing just that. The crust cracks and fills in with molten material. And it cracks again and fills in with molten material. So if you look at the continents of the Earth, not necessarily the beaches, but the continental shelves, all the continents once fit together just like a glove. Not in one place in the middle of the ocean on a planet our current size, but on a planet one-third our current size, all the continental shelves fit together like a key and a lock. But when you blow up the Earth like a balloon, slowly, the continents migrate around to where they are right now, and you can clearly see that the diameter of Earth has increased 300% from its original fast-spinning, hot form. Well, if the crust is expanding, that leaves behind the core. And so what you end up with is a void between the crust and the core, the counter-rotation of which causes the magnetosphere, which we enjoy and protects us from the sun's radiation.
Mm-hmm. It works for me. I know talking to some of the Tibetan lamas, they talk about their stories, and some of the yogis talk about it too, about these cities of very advanced beings living, Agartha, and they have all these other different places. And they have these doorways or caves that lead into these places, and they know where they are, and they keep, kind of keep them a secret. But it's kind of interesting. This folklore is so widespread, and there's so much evidence out there when you look at the historical evidence, you know, in these different traditions, that there does seem to be some kind of advanced civilization living within the interior somewhere. I'm not saying it's totally hollow, but there's definitely major hollowed out areas where advanced civilizations, and it's my understanding during the times of Atlantis and Lemuria, when the cataclysms hit, you know, the you know, we're talking 9500 BC or whatever, you know, these groups went inward. And a lot of them survived, and they went to the interior, and they kept their technology, the same technology they had back then. So I think a lot of these ships, a lot of these things we're experiencing are not just from other systems, other star systems. They're actually coming in from the inner Earth as well. And you know, who knows? Maybe this expedition right now is going to be the spearhead for a grand unification.
Well, it could be. And, of course, we, the organizers of this expedition, do feel, well, for lack of a better word, let's say we feel a cosmic responsibility that our integrity be unimpeachable, even if we're not, you know, perfect or the most brilliant people in the world. We are, each of us, feel like we're answering a call. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, we've spent many, many tens of thousands of dollars on this expedition, it's a labor of love. And we see that the event, the lesson that we could bring back from this, 15 days. Now, you've been to conferences. You have them at your ranch up there in Trout Lake. People come to your conferences for 3 days or 3.5 days, and they leave changed. They feel marvelous when they're at your ranch. But can you imagine 15 days and there's no leaving the place to go down to the little store for a sandwich? You're on that ship in a fixed environment, heavily immersed in a consciousness experiment at a place no human being has ever been, at least that we can tell on the surface of our planet. There could be some very marvelous changes, ascension experiences, in fact, take place among these people. And if a few of them, say 50 or 60 of them, come back and return to their domiciles, their places of employment, their teaching positions, with that ascension inside of them, they're going to change the planet. And that is a very amazing realization.
Yeah, that would be quite interesting. You really think of it, people have no idea how much their world presses in on them, and all the electromagnetic energy and the cell phones and HARP and you name it. You know, it's all going on around them. And to be totally in a space where you don't feel any of those influences and all the psychobabble and chatter and psychic influences, and to me that would just be amazing in itself to be sitting on, you know, the bow of that ship. You know, without all this other chatter going on, and just, I can just see it now, how uplifting that would be for your soul and how expansive, you know, that whole situation would become.
Well, you know, earlier in the program we were talking about the consciousness of the Earth, the spirit matter, or this energy body of the Earth. Astronomers and geologists alike realize that the flux, the magnetic flux of the Earth, the ion flow from the interior of the Earth, is extremely focused at the poles. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's widely accepted now, and even more so since the Themis probes that NASA sent up a year ago last February, accepted that the ion flow from the center of the Earth comes out of the poles, similar to that of a quasar. So we're going to be at a place where the Earth exhales large amounts of this ionic energy. And I can't help but think that there's going to be some kind of interaction between the humans that are on this expedition and the earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It to me, if you have an, even if you if there is this advanced civilization, and I fully do believe there is, their consciousness and energy after, you know, whatever, this many thousands of years, not having to deal with all the wars and cataclysms and starting over as primitive like we have and continuing to advance, you know, one can just imagine what kind of consciousness and energy you're going to be experiencing there, and we are definitely going to have to rise to the occasion and let go of a lot of the old baggage.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that there will be a plethora of books,
mm-hmm,
and stories and new lecturers joining the circuit after, mm-hmm, this expedition.
They need a lot of process-oriented therapies, you know, as we get closer to this these energies.
Well, we're going to have a story to tell. I can tell you that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's you know, the potential there is just unbelievable. The possibilities are just mind-boggling. I don't think we can wrap our heads around what's possible on this trip.
Well, I think generally people are getting pretty disappointed with the computer-generated expeditions that we see on the cable channels.
Mm-hmm.
Discovery and National Geographic and History and Science and you know, these expeditions are that they do on these cable channels are a few thousand dollars a piece, plugged full of commercials and a lot of sensationalism that really doesn't show anything. One program that's out there right now is a fairly, you know, long running series this year. Hasn't revealed a thing. I mean, nothing but innuendos and coincidences.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very inexpensive expedition. Maybe each episode costs $4,000 or $5,000. And people are seeing that. They're realizing that they're being taken for a commercial ride by a lot of these so-called documentary companies.
Mm-hmm.
This documentary is the real deal. On location in one of the most inhospitable places on Earth to a place no one has ever seen before. Real film, real people in a real location, no computer generation at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have, you know, definitely, hopefully there's some Russian translators there that so we can talk to the captains and give us a little heads up because they've been there, you know.
Oh, yeah, we have two translators. One lives right here in Washington State. Mm-hmm. She used to be an official with the Russian Railroad.
Okay.
And she's very well adept at the language and understands the protocol.
Yeah, I've got a friend that speaks fluent Russian, and he's actually from Russia, but born here. His whole family's from Russia, and actually, you haven't met him yet, but I know you will shortly, but amazing guy. He's helped me out quite a bit here. But,
well, I'm excited about it.
Yeah, we get a little heads up from these guys and say, okay, what time do you go out on the deck and what time do you not go out on the deck?
Well, there's no sundown, you know, for 15 days. It's sun up.
When do the big waves come? I think I've already done that one. I don't know if that experience.
Yeah, well, it's in the North Sea. It's notoriously inhospitable seas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of big storms generates out of that area.
Now, it's not necessarily the storms. It's the steady wind,
yeah,
and the fact that the tides in that area are not like you see in Southern California. They go up and down maybe 8 feet. We're talking 45-foot tides.
Wow.
That's a long, long way for an ocean to move,
mm-hmm,
and it creates a huge amount of hydraulic energy.
Oh, boy, I can imagine pushing on all the icebergs and everything else there.
Sure, yeah, you bet.
I don't think we're going to be seeing any, though. From what I understand, we're going to have open water.
Yeah, it should be open water pretty much the whole way, but we'll be crunching ice for at least 6 days.
Mm-hmm. I've heard some of the scientists now are saying by, you know, I think it was this fall or spring, I can't remember exactly when, that there may be no ice left.
No, it refreezes. It refreezes at the rate of about 10,000 square miles a day. And we're going late in the year. We're going August 17th all the way up to the 1st of September. So, you know, we will definitely be in icy conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds, well, I'm all for open water, but ice works too if we need to do ice. You know.
Yeah, well, the point is that it does refreeze. 2006, the Northwest Passage completely opened up free of ice, and then non-icebreakers could actually get in there. But they had a very short amount of time to get in there and get out. My great-grandfather almost lost his life twice up there, did lose a crew once, and he got rescued because his sailing vessel could not get out faster than the ice was forming.
Wow.
And they actually had to spend 2 months on that ship locked in the ice,
mm-hmm.
and many of them died.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time. I think we have a caller here, but I think we're out of time. We're hitting the end of the hour, so we'll be having to sign off. Can you give your websites, one for the Inner Earth Expedition and then your own website? To
sure.
People
the expedition website is nipie.org, N-P-I-E-E.org. And just contact us using the forms that are there. And then the books are available at ARC, like Noah's Ark, of millionsofyears.com. If you can't find that, just Google Brooks Agnew or Ark of Millions of Years, and it'll take you right to the website. We have a Christmas holiday special going on right now where you can buy all three books for a special price in the U.S., which includes shipping.
Right. You know, and also, too, you have your own show here, X Squared Radio.
Yep,
so
X Squared
DBS,
Radio every Sunday evening from 5 to 8 p.m.
Sounds great. Well, it's been an awesome, enlightening pleasure, as usual, talking with you, and we're out of time, so I can't thank you enough for coming on the show.
My pleasure, James.
We'll do it again soon.
Anytime.
All right, this is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio, signing off. Have an incredible evening. Good night.
Bye-bye.